Welcome to Cloudlandia,
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Jackson, you sound a bit older.
I do. I actually, you know, I am 1 year older, 55 years old now.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? So
it happens, you know. It happens.
This is the 1 week out of the year when we are slightly out of sync in our 22-year age gap, because you will be very, very shortly 77.
Yes, that's very correct. So that'll be on Wednesday.
On Wednesday, you'll be 77, and that will mark... I think that will remove the statute of limitations on my the permanent record of my one occasion of lying to you.
Yes.
On your 70th birthday.
Yes,
So all is forgiven, I think. After 7 years, the record is obliterated. But I'm back to a perfect record.
Yes. Yeah. So, did you have a good time?
I had a great time. We went to Longboat Key and spent some time at the beach and
relaxed. That's on the Keys, is it?
It's a key off of the coast of Sarasota. So it's a little key there. So it's about 2 hours from my house.
Yes.
Just wonderful. We stayed at a place called the Longboat Key Beach Resort. And it was, the beaches there are just so nice. Sand, the powder kind of sand. All the Gulf beaches are really, really nice. And the weather was perfect. It's nice to have some thinking time and to... just disconnect for a little bit.
Yeah, I was thinking, I've been thinking recently about what determines people's feeling of aging.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think is that there are the calendar, of course, says that they're a day older or a week, month, or quarter older. But I think it's they're not learning anything new, not developing any new capabilities, not discovering anything new. And I think that's what determines people's feeling of aging.
Like, I say to people, I don't feel any different than I did at 22. Mentally, curiosity, joy and engagement and all of those, positive things. Mm-hmm. Physically, I feel different than I did at 22, but mentally and my spirit, I feel the same, but I feel like so much more, I've had way more, experience. Now, and I imagine imagine at 77 do you feel any different?
It's really interesting. We have a new thinking process and that I'm testing out on our 2 hour, we have our 2 hour connector calls between quarterly workshops, and I came up with one two or three weeks ago, and I don't think that you caught it because I think it's been within the last week or so, and it's called Why You're a Great Who. And it reverses the thinking. I mean, since Who Not How, by the way, we're at 120 now registrations because of Who Not How.
That's so great.
Into the program. Yeah, and 28 are just read the book, click on the website and sign up with no no discussion with a strategic coach.
It's one of those concepts that once it does what it says on the tin, once you get it, the insight is within the words. You get it and you understand what that means, and you say, you understand immediately that I need that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We're up over 900 with our Amazon reviews. So there's been a, just a big bunch of reviews. And we're at 4.6 out of, a possible total five. We're at 4.6. And Robert Cialdini was at Genius X 2 weeks ago. And he was saying that reviews are kind of the part of a whole vast universe, which is called Peersuasion.
Mm-hmm.
That's his next book. It's called Peersuasion, and it's how you count with people who are kind of like you.
Yes.
You know, sort of resonant to your, in a network. And so he said the sweet spot with a review, like a book review, is between 4.2 and 4.7. He's discovered that. And so we're at 4.6. So we're at the higher level of the sweet spot. But it was very interesting because I have one review that's a one star. It's a one star out of five. So I wanted to go see what this person had to say, and I found
what was it?
The person said, why do you even have to read the book? Everything you need to know is on the cover.
There it is, you see?
And I said, well, that wasn't such a bad review.
That's great, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought that was humorous because he was angry because the question whether I think it was a he. The question was whether he does anything with the thought. You know, that's really whether it's valuable.
That's like that Never Eat Alone book. You don't even need to read it. Yep. It's just there it is. Never Eat Alone.
Yeah.
Okay.
And So anyway, it's great. But the ones that, you and I are, constant conversationalists ever since we've known each other about marketing. How do you attract someone's attention and then engage with that person in the most economical way, in other words, the most productive way.
Yes.
And my sense is, that the book is written through a collaboration, not requiring much time on my part. And the book is out there, it's a note in a bottle, really. We've got more than 100,000 bottles out floating around, and then the person reads the book and is persuaded enough to go to our website and not only find out about us but to actually sign up at the, and that's very economical from start to finish. That's a very economical idea. And then we put up the cover on Amazon. We put up the cover for The Gap and the Gain, which is for this October. And in the first week, we had 1,000 orders already. So
that's great.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my story.
Things are shaping up. This is awesome. I'd love to hear all of that.
Yeah, but the idea of why you're a great who, what I do is I simply have you identify from your past activities that clearly indicated at a much earlier age why you're such a great who now, activities that you're doing right now that would represent why you're a great who, and then possibilities for the future that would even expand why you're a great who. And you write three, three, and three. And then under the past column, I have you write down what are the lessons that you got from these past experiences, doing the past experience, that you're presently using lessons. And then what are the best projects in the present that where you're using the most of why you're a great who? And then what are the three possibilities in the future that would even up the game? You would even be more of being a great who. And then insights, and then they talk about it. And it's very emotional. I was kind of surprised. I tried it last Tuesday. And one of our 10 times connectors. And the thing that it did, if I can sum up what I think was the strongest response to it, was that all of a sudden people began to see that when they were children, they were actually heading in the direction of, you know, what makes them a great who right now.
Right.
So you were talking about 22. So probably at 22, you were well on the path to being a great who.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's great, because that's the great, that was the great awakening, you know, learning about. I'd always been attracted to entrepreneurship and, you know, the results economy, because that's, you know, my only ever one job at the bowling alley. cured me of working per hour, you know, for a regular job in favor of the results economy of selling coupon books door to door. That was just, that was a great lesson. And the ability to overcome, you know, to develop the ability to go and knock on people's doors and talk to strangers.
Yeah.
And try and money.
Big changes in your lifetime, in my lifetime, compared to today, is that you know, children and teenagers are not getting the same amount of possibility.
It's true.
Even having a normal job, able to have even a normal job in many cases. And you know, I mean, I forget who I was talking to, one of the clients, but he said that, he's got a son in college, and the son, they were visiting, and they had sort of a hangout with the son and a number of the other students. And he just noticed that they were, you know, they seemed to be clueless about how money was made, how money was created, and you know, how the economy grows and everything else. And and it was very interesting, because he got talking to them, and he said that you know, that he said they've got all sorts of magical thinking about how things actually happen. You know, they don't really have a sense that value has to be created, and the value is in the eyes of the, you know, the person who's paying for it. And they'll pay a little, they'll pay or a lot, depending on how valuable it is. And it hadn't gotten across to them that that's fundamentally what's involved. For your personal finances, but also just, you know, billions of people. This is how things actually move. Mm-hmm. This is how things are actually created. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's why there's an upswing in UFO sightings right now.
There were, you know, that's so funny.
There's an absence. There's an absence of real understanding how things work. So, you know, so you're your thinking goes very far afield if you don't really understand.
It's pretty interesting, like what is happening right now. If you see the UFO files, you know, if you're observing, it feels like the Navy and the government is getting, and I don't know what, I think the media is portraying it as admitting that there's things that they don't know. But this, all this, the recent activity seems to be around these orbs that splashed into the ocean just recently.
Yeah.
Have you seen about those?
Yeah, I actually saw a video
about
an hour before I came on this morning. I was looking at one. It's got to qualify on three counts. Is it unidentified? Yep, it's unidentified.
Is it flying?
Yes, it's flying. Yes, it is. And is it
an object?
It seems to be an object.
That right there is an unidentified flying object. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, people said, you know, I mean, aliens. I said, oh, no, they didn't say it was aliens. They said it was an unidentified flying object, and I totally
agree. That's what
agree.
You got there. Yeah, what is that? I don't know.
I don't know. And, you know, they interviewed Navy pilots who spotted things and actually taken photos. And
yes.
The one this morning that I saw was from shipboard. They were taking a video of that. And I said, well, if what shows up on their video is what they saw, there's definitely, I have to say, that was an unidentified flying object.
Yes. And it's interesting how the media now, they're turning that into, are there aliens? You know, like that would be, they're saying that. So the thing I thought was, if that is, it would be the most profound event in human history.
I think that would be true.
I think that would be true. I think like that is stating the enormity of it and yet understating it at exactly the same time. The most profound outcome in human history. I mean,
but I wouldn't, you know, I actually wouldn't turn on my television set to watch it because, you know, I've got my campaign
television
going. So I would, I'd probably go onto the internet to see what's actually happening there.
Well, that,
yeah, I was just watching the watching. I mean, talk about incredible the barrage of rockets that were fired at Israel and how the Iron Dome technology was, you know, picking them off, you know, and you just see, you know, hundreds of these rockets in the air. And then the Israeli defense, the Iron Dome defense thing, they shoot them up and they're boom, 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 you know, and, so they said that they were about 90% good this time. They able to knock the rockets out. And anyway,
isn't that
crazy? We had clients about 10 years ago from Alabama, and they worked on components of that system. They actually, things like that. There's probably technology of the nature of Iron Dome, and if no one knows what I'm talking about, it's a defense missile so that if a enemy launches a rocket through satellite technology, they can detect the launch and immediately they can calculate the trajectory of the rocket, the enemy rocket, hostile rocket. And then they determine where that's going to land. And if it's just going to land in an empty space, they let it just explode. But if it's looking like it's going to hit a populated area, then they send a rocket up and their rocket knocks out the other rocket.
Well, this is just, I mean, where would you even start to create stuff like that? Like, so you just realize there are people just intellectually on a whole nother level?
Well, it's because there was, I think, probably humans who were better at other humans in calculating trajectory. In other words, they were actually in, it's like baseball players. It always still to this day amazes me that, the pitcher will pitch and it's a, looks like it's going to be a home run, or it looks like it's going to be a hit. And one of the fielders, center fielder, whichever fielder, runs straight and arrives just as the ball comes down. But apparently, first of all, they've done it before.
That's true.
Thing, they have the experience. But the other thing is they've done it so often that they know from doing it 1,000 times or 2,000 times, right off the bat, they knew about 95% where it's going to land. And then they have to speed up, and then they have to calculate, and then they catch the ball. So if you think of human abilities, that we develop all these enormous abilities and we do them over and over and over again, it looks like magic at a certain point, because your brain has calculated the odds, and it's got the odds pretty good of exactly what's going to happen here. And then at a certain point, this can be documented and it can be programmed into computer, into a technological system. And one of the things that I put an emphasis on, there's always been this discussion, with entrepreneurs and Genius Network at Abundance 360 and, in our own workshops, where people say, why do you have so many people? Why do you have so many people in your company? And I said, first of all, I like having a lot of people. And I said, if they're always growing and taking on new skills, then it's not really a cost. It's an investment. It's really an investment. And when something unexpected happens or something brand new happens, if you've had people who have successfully taken on and completed, dozens of new projects in the past, they just treat it like a new project, like switching to Zoom backstage so that everybody was working from home. Mm-hmm. That was just a new project, and it was done in 3 days. Then we have to switch, and now instead of in person, we're doing it by Zoom. But that's just a new project, so we're doing this new project. So if you have teams of people who are just always used to improving their skills and taking on new challenges, then there's not a great negativity to the new thing. It's just a new thing that you're doing.
Right. Yeah, this is...
So we're bigger. I mean, we let go 23 people right off the bat, within mm-hmm. the first 2 days. And they had all been hired within the previous 6 months. Mm-hmm. And they weren't engaged yet. They were still in their training period, so they weren't really engaged. But we weren't losing productivity. We let them know. And the reason is that we wanted to have a company-wide meeting on the fourth day. And you had to, if you're going to let people go, you had to do it in the first two, three days. And so it was really interesting. And then we went from 130 down to 107. And now we're back up to about 119. So during the past year, some have left. Some people have left over the, but what I'm noticing is just this very, very high skill level. We have 70 people have been with us for more than 10 years,
That's and, what's great, isn't it? Like that level of inside knowledge, you know, specialized knowledge about both as a teamwork and as the culture and everything. That goes a long way.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a feeling that we as a company did it really well, you know, because, you know, there's companies that didn't do it well. And, you know, they get the news, they watch the news, they listen to what their friends are saying and everything. But the interesting thing is that our global program, our virtual global program, which we started in September of last year, so we're, you know, what's that, 7 months? Yeah, it's about 7 months. And we've got 390 signed-ups.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's the, I mean, really, I just saw a great article I was reading this morning. I start, I wish I could remember where I found it. I did bookmark the article, but it started out with a New York Times article about Mr. Beast that I found, and then it was through linking out to these. But somebody had done the landscape of what they're calling economy, which is the new word to describe what we're what we've created now in the last 10 years. It's really only 10 years old, and that's what Mr. Beast is, part of this creator economy, meaning people who are making things on YouTube, creating content. I would call, under that definition, I would be in the creator economy. You would be in the creator economy, all of these things, right? Where we're creating content that we share with a global audience. And they did a estimation of the landscape of the creator economy, and there's about 50 million people in the creator economy, they guesstimate. Not guesstimate, they went, it was very specifically formulated by the number of people, the number of YouTube accounts that are over a certain amount that have 100,000 or more subscribers, kind of thing, that those are what they're calling the professional creator economy. And same with Instagram and you know, all of that.
Yeah.
And so when you look at that, it's very neatly the it's very neatly 1% of the global online community of 5 billion people. And so there's something, you know, it was really interesting to see, because the if we start to look at that, it's really only been possible the last, it's really only been possible over the last 10 years that this has all evolved. Which, you know, that's pretty, it's pretty great. And, you know, to think about that, there's so much, where it's essentially alchemy. You know, that's really what I was describing it as years ago, that when we talked about Eben Pagan and I had a really great discussion one time. We were talking about how, you know, currencies and things used to be on the gold standard, where it was, you know, attached to physical, you know, something, to a physical asset. And I was kind of taking the side that, because everybody was alarmed, you know, saying how when we switched to a fiat currency, that that's like, that was the beginning of the end kind of thing. But the fact that the economy itself, the world itself is moving, or at the time was moving, into a situation where we could create money from nothing. You know, this was 20 years ago. We were having this discussion, and, you know, I was making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year selling a digital book, which is literally like selling a picture of a book, right? It's not even selling a physical book. And yet that money was being exchanged with no physical impact on that would ever show up GDP or trade deficit or, you know, because it's all about physical goods, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. There was a book written probably about 20 years ago, and it just got updated. And I don't know both the authors, but one of his name is Mark Mills. And Mark Mills is a thinker about energy-related matters. And he's with an institute called the Manhattan Institute, which is sort of an entrepreneurial think tank. So they're very definitely, you know, geared towards value creation, innovation, and everything like this. And I've listened to Mark Mills. I've seen YouTubes of him. And but this is a fascinating book, and the thesis, the name of the book is The Bottomless Well. And he said, and his thesis is that you can tell how advanced a civilization is or a society is by the sheer amount of energy that they can waste.
The sheer amount of energy they can waste. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. For example, if you think of a laser beam, there's just a phenomenal amount of energy that has been essentially wasted to actually, you know, go through all the research and the development and the tech, you know, the buildup of technology to the point where you could get a laser beam. And it just uses up a phenomenal amount of energy, and most of it is wasted energy in the sense that it's just thrown off as heat. You know, I mean, starting with either coal or natural gas that's required to produce the electricity, and then all the energy that's required to even manufacture the technology. And he said that the U.S. is the number one country in the world. And he says, surely on the basis that the U.S. wastes more energy than any other country on the planet. And I thought it was a really, really interesting. He says, this would be sort of an indicator of where we are right now. And, the article that you just talked about, the 50 million who are in the new economy, they're in the part of the economy that exists because of the incredibly high waste of energy.
That is true. So here's, I found the article. It was from the Signal Fire blog. And this was an interesting, so
I'd appreciate it if you'd send it on to me.
Of course I will. So here's they got an infographic that shows that there are 50 million content creators serving our 5 billion community. So 1% is feeding the 99% bottomless well of attention to be wasted, right? And so they're estimating that there are 46.7 million amateur creators and 2 million professional creators, meaning, which that's kind of an interesting, here's how they break that down. Of YouTube, has 31 million channels on YouTube, and 1 million of them have over 10,000 subscribers.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So on Instagram, 1 billion accounts on Instagram, and approximately 500,000 have over 100,000 followers. And it's interesting that there are approximately 200,000 musicians, writers, illustrators, podcasters. So we mm-hmm. fall into that category there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty, interesting, those are some pretty interesting stats, you know?
Well, think about, go back to your starting number of 50 million.
Yeah.
Those individuals have been essentially freed up from having to do things for survival for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's kind of like the entire global society right now is capable of 50 million. So if you measured 10 years from now and it was up to 100 million, that means that you've had an enormous growth of your global economy in a 10-year period.
Yeah, I look at the, I've been contemplating, thinking about the, how much of what we do, how much of the economy, because you heard the words when we were, these were quarantine thoughts I was having, that essential workers, right? What, yes. What are essential workers? And I thought about how much of what we do is really at the tippy top of Maslow's hierarchy.
Yes.
That the majority of what we're doing is non-essential, seems like, you know? Like when you take, if you look at just all of the people that you come into contact with and what their business is or what their job is or how they're employed, there's a lot of stuff that is, you would deem non-essential. Like mm-hmm. that are not, like you think about the whole entertainment world, all of this, and none of YouTube is essential. None of this whole, the creator economy is not essential, right? It's kind of a, and it's funny
yeah,
how
it's kind of like, yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like, in the health insurance market, what is insurable and what is considered elective surgery, for
right.
example, in other words, your surgery will be covered by insurance, but if you're doing plastic surgery, that would not be covered by insurance. That's elective. And you could use
right.
the same words for this.
That's a good idea.
It's actually
an elective economy. That's great.
Yeah.
That's a really good distinction, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not an essential economy. It's an elective economy.
Yeah. And that's pretty interesting. When we look at the, when we surround ourselves, we look at the people that we work with, even, I wouldn't say we're in the elective economy. That's for sure. Being an entrepreneur is an elective.
One of the things I was thinking, Peter Diamandis and I had a conversation about 2 weeks ago. We did a number of podcasts, and he had just interviewed Elon Musk, he had an hour long interview that went out on his channel.
I saw part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were talking about Elon, and I said, you know, my suspicion is that the value of, he puts it all in, I think he puts everything under Tesla. It's called the Tesla. And, you know, and that, you know, it's very, very highly rated, and his portion of it makes him the number one or number two wealthiest person in the planet, just going on stock holdings. And I said to Peter, yeah, I said, you know, I think that 50% of the value of what people are investing in is the man himself. I said, because if you really take Tesla apart as a car company, and, you know, you don't know the name of the car company, but they're selling this many cars, it shouldn't be as high it is, you know. It they don't. They sell. You know, they're getting up near the half million mark a year. Uh-huh. But you know, Toyota sells 9. You know, they sell 9 million a year. You know, like it's they're 18 times as big. Yeah. And I said, there's something that is extra about Elon Musk. That it's people are actually not so much investing what Elon says he's working on. It's that they'll invest in anything that Elon is working on because he's Elon.
Mm-hmm.
And because it seems to me that, you know, if you take somebody who's working on things, you know, are they essential or they're elective? I think they're all elective. I think everything he's working on is elective. And my sense is that he's developed a whole way of thinking about that, and he's put together how you fund it and how you package it and how you present it, and you know, how you get the word out and everything like that. So he's really created an entire system. And I said the number one message that I think comes across from Elon, there's others that's true, is that he would bet his life on a really big idea, and that's totally elective to bet your life on a really big idea.
Yeah.
And if he fails, he doesn't care because I'm sure he cares, but what I'm saying is he's not asking.
Because we're living in a simulation anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not asking anyone to bail him out. You know, I mean, if he fails, he's not asking anyone to bail him out. But I've got this exciting idea and you think it's worth betting on, you know, that's really what he's done. And you and I mean, we're just 2 out of 8 billion on the planet.
Yeah.
And if we screw up and we don't produce anything, it doesn't really matter.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been thinking about
it's totally
Elon.
Elective. So my sense is your amount of freedom, you know, I have the four freedoms, freedom of time, money, relationship, and purpose. Your elective score is really a function of how much freedom that you've been able to create for yourself.
Uh-huh. Yes, I agree with that. 100%.
In other words, if you drop back, we've just named a new economy. If you drop back and look at yourself, how much freedom of time do you have compared to 20 years ago? Much greater freedom of time.
That's
same thing
true.
With money, same thing with relationships, same thing with purpose.
Yes.
But
that's the
all
thing,
those
it all
freedoms,
fails. Yeah.
All those freedoms you've elected to have, you know. Yeah. And your formula, I'll know I'm successful when, feeds into those four freedoms. And those four freedoms makes what you do more and more elective.
Yeah. And isn't it, I mean, yeah, I'm amazed by how durable my desires are. You know, when I look back even at my old journals that, that's the right word. I think durable list has been, it's
well, they're not, the Nisam Taleb, if you've ever read any of his books, The Black Swan and, Anti-Fragile. And he says he says that bet on things that are anti-fragile. In other words, that you don't know what kind of disruptions there's going to be in the future. So bet on things today that you think doesn't matter what kind of disruptions, this bet will still work out.
That's Warren Buffett's durable advantage, durable moat, or moat of certainty around something that's what he said. He doesn't know which technologies are going to win, but he's certain that 50 years from now, men are going to wake up with whiskers.
Mm-hmm.
And King Gillette is going to be there to save the mm-hmm. day. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're going to love hamburgers and want Coke.
And I think, I think about that every morning that I have a Zoom call, public Zoom call, where I'm doing a thing. And when I come around and shave, I say to myself, don't nick yourself now. You're going to be on camera.
Yes.
And I appreciate, I don't use Gillette. What's the other one?
Use Gillette? Is that your Schick?
Well, it's one of those that's, it's electric and it's got five blades that vibrate,
Oh, my goodness. Norelco?
No, it's not an electric shaver. It's a regular shaver. It's just got battery. It's battery operated.
Oh, I see.
And it just vibrates.
Oh, yeah.
And, it tells you, it tells me right now that their advertising has been a complete failure because I love the product, but I can't remember who makes it.
That's so funny. I use that same one and I can't remember.
But I noticed that I'm really, really careful. I'm really, really careful. And I said, 30 years ago, this would have been really, really dicey. I first shaved at age maybe 13, something like that. And, it was a razor blade that you put in, but you could cut yourself.
Yeah, the safety blade,
Yeah, well, they were safety. I think they were safety blade because it wasn't a straight razor. You weren't using you weren't using a knife, form of a knife and everything else. But I just appreciate the progress that they've made in the technology over the years. And, and as you say, fads will come and go regarding facial hair, but probably the majority of people will,
at least trim it around. So Dan, I thought of a great, have you had any more thoughts or anybody brought anything up about NFTs for you, non-fungible tokens?
There's a constant buzz about it, some people are, I can notice are really looking into it. And Joe is spending his elective time during sabbatical year to he sent a kit over to us of things that he thought were useful to read.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to go through those this week because I have a free week this week. And I'm just going to, read them, watch them. And every quarter, it's a forever project. Every quarter you want to know more about this.
Yeah. I think I thought of a great idea for an NFT. Digital passport to Cloudlandia.
Hmm.
Digital citizenship in Cloudlandia.
That'd be a good one.
I think so too.
So you're you, in the sense that they're going to receive some curation about this, right?
Say more about that. I hadn't thought that through.
Well, a passport. what I got from that is, what are they actually investing in? You know, they're putting money down today for something that's going to be more valuable as it as time goes by. What's going to become more valuable about their passport?
Oh, see, there we go. I hadn't thought that part through.
I just wonder how you're going to hook them with nine words. That's all.
I wonder too. You just got to point me in the right direction, and then the words will come to me.
Because my interest in it is that not so much NFT as such, but that blockchain is a very, very fast, very, very cheap new form of intellectual property protection.
Yes. Yeah, I think the...
And all the IP lawyers and all the IP lawyers I've talked to think it's nonsense, and that tells me it's really important.
Well, because they're invested. That'd be like, imagine if you go to the land registry office, they'll probably tell you the same thing. But you know, it could certainly see a time when.
Well, I mean, what I understand is that it's verified, trustworthy, statement of ownership.
Yes.
I don't know. If it looks like a UFO and it flies,
Right, exactly.
That damn thing that they're filming there, that is... verifiable proof of ownership,
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and that's, because I'm sitting there and I'm just noticing, all the work and process and complexity that we've gone through since 1989 with, using one of the intellectual property tools, whether it, we have one that's a patent. The strategy circle is a patent. And that's the only patent we have. And then we have registered trademarks. We have registered copyrights. But my sense is that for what seems to be like a very, very nominal amount of money, you can register something as a smart contract on the blockchain.
Right.
And that's global. That's instantly global.
Yeah.
It's not United States. It's not Canada. It's global. Because the blockchain is global, and I'm really intrigued with it. We would practice on ourselves, but what I'd like to do is to have some very enterprising entrepreneurs who would like to have this as a business that you can, use their services, because people still know somebody. I'm not asking entrepreneurs to learn a new how. I'm simply asking them to consider that if they had a who instantly took their new ideas and logged them as smart contracts on the blockchain, that they might be interested in using that service. And I already have a couple of people who are heading in that direction. So, So anyway.
Well, that's interesting.
Passport. Tell me about your passport.
The idea was, just that, because I don't know enough about what the NFTs are, but I know, I was thinking about just collectibles, people are collecting trading cards or, LeBron dunks. I wasn't thinking about it as a contract with adding things up to it, but just to literally have a almost like an art piece made of a digital image of a Cloudlandia passport, and have them numbered that you could be a registered kind of Cloudlandian.
Yeah.
And how would that, you know, would I mean, be the, you know, from what you know about it, what do you think?
No, let's go for it.
Yeah, because I'm thinking
The only thing we're in danger of is learning something new.
That was my point, is that's what I think it would be a fun thing to learn, and it could be a good platform for anybody to learn along with us, because it could be a fun way for people to get, you know, access or updates to what's going on in Cloudlandia.
The other thing is that we can promote it shamelessly.
Yes, exactly. Because we're part of the self-appointed creator economy.
We're part of the self-elected.
Yeah, and I mean citizenship in Cloudlandia, which we named and created out of our imaginations, is, you know, we could be the joint emperors of Cloudlandia.
Yeah, we're like the guardians.
The guardians of Cloudlandia. I was thinking about what would make a, like, your American, your good American checklist. Is, I wonder what it means to be a Cloudlandian.
Yeah, I'm changing the name in July because July seems to be a good month in which to change the name of your podcast.
Yes,
July. And it's going to be American Happiness. American Happiness, and the reason is that according to the internet, doesn't matter which side you are, there aren't many that are.
Right.
I mean, seems like there's a lot of unhappy Americans.
That's true.
And I said, so, you know, how's that working?
Right.
And so I said, let's just make it American Happiness. Let's just have a growing community of Americans who declare themselves happy. You know,
yeah.
And pass it on, you know, just.
You know,
and, yeah, I mean, boy, you know, I mean, looks to me like Americans have it pretty good.
Yes. Is that what we are, that we are inalienable, the right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness? Is that what it was?
Yeah, but I think that it's kind of made people crazy because, pursuing happiness just seems like a how to me.
Yes. Yeah, that is interesting.
Why don't you just recognize, oh, I'm happy, you know. I'm happy, and tomorrow I figure out a way to be happier, and, like, you know, 90 days from now, I think I'll be happier too. And
be giddy.
And I'm making up the rules, and I'm making up the measurements. So,
right.
I'm just going to self-declare that I'm a happy American.
That's awesome. By the way, I meant to ask, what is your, are you going to do this as a quarterly book as well?
No. That's the plan. And I'll co-author it with Mark Young, because we developed the idea over 3 years. So it'll be...
Yes.
Dr. Mark Young.
Doctor.
And, he's got a doctorate in psychology in the area of hypnotism.
Uh-huh.
Hypnotism. Yeah. From the University of Toronto. Yeah.
Nice.
And, But anyway, I think that, you know why I would like to do this passport, is that we'll be compelled to go deeper with our thinking about why this is a significant thing.
Uh-huh. Well, I know. I mean, these things that we're seeing here, this whole creator economy, that's really, it's all happening within this world of Cloudlandia. That's really the wrapper around all of it.
Yeah, I mean, to use a previous transformation of its kind, there's no question that the ability to read was a major jump forward. That someone could look at a page with all sorts of marks on it and get total meaning out of it.
Right.
You know, and think of, you know, all the technology that had to develop before there was even a page.
Yeah.
You could put marks on it and everything like that. And I think that we're going through something very akin it's not what I would say intuitive.
No.
It's not really intuitive, is that that it's a way of thinking that requires an extraordinary amount of pre-development that you've been doing over the last 10 years before you kind of get what the significance of this new thing is.
And that's when you really realize it. I mean, I was doing some kind of timelining in my journal the other day that, I came up with these where I was thinking about how to focus like it's 1999. Because it was easier to focus in 1999 for me. Part of the reason was because the internet was still a place that you would go to. And in 2007, when the iPhone came out, now it was a place, now the internet was always with you. You always brought the internet with you. And once you always had it with you, that's when that was the big bang for Cloudlandia.
It was so funny because Mike Koenig and I have done two podcasts, I think, on blockchain and NFTs.
Yeah.
I've definitely got some ideas about what I think is happening here. But Mike says, well, you know, why don't you just explain, you know, kind of how the cloud chain works? And I said, I just have to put out a warning to the listeners that I still haven't figured where the cloud is.
Right, right.
They call it the cloud. I know what a cloud is. Where is it? Everything like that. And then where's this chain? You know, where's this chain? And
right.
And black and everything like that. But I do get a sense that the central issue here is establishing a foundation, a global foundation for trust.
Yes.
Among strangers. That a stranger... Yeah. 12 time zones away from me, sees that I have a smart contract on the blockchain that relates directly to what we're talking about. So, it's totally trustworthy then. And I don't even have to know this person.
Right. Yeah, it's one of those things, you know, it reminds me of, one of the famous, television clips is Bryant Gumbel and Hoda.
what is
internet? What is internet?
Dot com.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and I think we're doing that, and it's the sharp edge. You know, it's the sharp edge of the razor. You know, I mean, the people, but there's a growing population of individuals who, number one, want this, and their wanting kind of creates it, they're making use of it. So well, that was a very full go, and
another
next time I will have caught up with that little advantage you had for about 9 days.
That's right. There we go.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
That's great. Have you got any plans?
Yeah, Peter Diamandis was born early hours of the 20th of May, but I was born at 9 o'clock, the 19th of May, 9 o'clock in the mm-hmm. evening. So I always have about a, you know, I have about a 9 hour, I get this old 9 hour spurt, you know.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, I'll send you that article, Dan, that I found, both the New York Times and the Creator Economy article.
Well, I love it. I really love it.
And I'll put both in the show notes for
Thank
everybody
you.
Listening. Okay.
Okay.
Have a great week, Dan.
And I'm on for next. If all goes well, we'll talk a week from now.
Me too. Okay. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay. Bye.